Hello, I'm Lina Ahmadu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at the work of the Non-Governmental Organization Partners in Health, or PHI, in Liberia and Lesotho. But first, more than 85% of cervical cancer cases and deaths occur in low- and middle-income countries, and the World Health Organization says the disease burdens the most vulnerable groups. As the world marked the fourth anniversary of the launch of the Global Strategy to Eliminate Cervical Cancer as a Public Health Problem, the WHO says the disease is still the fourth most common cancer in women globally. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
The WHO reports that the highest rates of cervical cancer incidence and mortality are in sub-Saharan Africa, Central America, and Southeast Asia. November 17th is observed as the Cervical Cancer Elimination Day of Action. This year's theme is Elevating Frontline Health Workers, Transforming Global Commitments into Life-Saving Actions. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus says frontline health workers play a vital role in shaping the delivery of effective interventions for cervical cancer prevention, treatment, palliative care, and survivorship care.
Years ago today, WHO and communities around the world made a historic commitment to eliminate cervical cancer, one of the few cancers that can be prevented and cured if detected early. The support of advocates, partners, and communities are driving progress towards our shared 90-70-90 targets of vaccination, screening, and treatment. To date, 144 countries have introduced the HPV vaccine into national immunization programs, and many are also rolling out next-generation diagnostics.
He was speaking in a video comments the WHO released. Even though cervical cancer is highly detectable and curable, the disease is still one of the most common cancers worldwide. WHO member states are tasked with ensuring 90% of girls are vaccinated with the HPV vaccine by the age of 15. 70% of women are screened using high-performance tests by the age of 35, and treating 90% of women with precancer and those with invasive cancer by 2030. Most cases are caused by human papillomavirus, which the HPV vaccine prevents. According to the WHO, regional differences in the cervical cancer burden are related to inequalities in access to vaccination, screening, and treatment services. Women living with HIV are six times more likely to develop cervical cancer compared to the general population.
While we are making progress, we still face huge inequities, with women in low-income countries bearing most of the burden. Only with strong leadership and sustained investment can we achieve our shared goal of equitable access for communities most in need. Together, let's make cervical cancer history.
The WHO calls for support from around the world to recognize and lift up the contributions of frontline health workers providing life-saving services to eliminate cervical cancer. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
Medical experts are sounding the alarm on the growing incidence of cancer in some communities, highlighting health disparities. According to the American Cancer Society, black men have the highest rates of prostate cancer, while black women face disproportionately higher rates of breast cancer and more aggressive forms of the disease. The WHO reports that cancer rates in Africa are increasing by about 20% annually, with breast cancer being the most common among women and prostate cancer prevalent in men. Experts are calling for increased awareness, improved healthcare access, and investment in cancer research to address these disparities. For more insight, I spoke with Dr. Will Ngwa, Director of the Global Health Catalyst with Johns Hopkins.
Cancer care disparities are a major issue worldwide, and even within the United States, access often depends on factors like zip code and income. What are your thoughts on this issue, and also when it comes to Africa?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you hit the nail on the nail right there with it, because I think the cancer situation in Africa is really, becoming a crisis where we actually recently, the Lancet Oncology Commission for Sub-Saharan Africa showed that, it's about 1 million deaths per year by 2030 if we don't do something about that. And what we see, like you've mentioned, is that there are lots of cancers that are really predominant, like prostate, breast, and cervical cancer. And when you look at these cancers, these are the same cancers that in the United States you see a lot of disparities around. And these disparities are really driven by factors like genetics, you know, maybe just being black. In Africa, they are more predisposed to breast cancer, having breast cancer early. But a lot of them are also because of systemic factors, just like, you know, the zip code where you live in, maybe a poorer zip code, you know, the food you eat. And in Africa, the rising incidence is partly attributed to that, because now more people are adopting Western diets and other risk factors, like with HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. That's made cervical cancer the leading cause of cancer deaths there in Africa.
So, Dr. Ngwa, how do we close the gaps? There are some initiatives that you are leading to help address this issue. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited about a couple of initiatives that we've been working on. So one, first of all, is has really been engagement with the White House, which has really heard about President Biden's cancer moonshot. So over the past year, since it was ignited in 2022, President Biden, there have been a lot of initiatives that have extended that cancer moonshot to Africa. First, when the president hosted the U.S.-Africa Leaders Conference in 2022, in December, you know, there was a commitment of over $300 million from the private sector and the U.S. government to support care in Africa. And then more recently, we had a White House Africa Forum that was really focused, resulting in another, you know, $100 million in commitments. So that's a really major, you know, opportunity for the U.S. to continue to show leadership and help collaborate with Africa in addressing the cancer incident. Me personally, yeah.
So would you say that if we are to move the needle on the continent, I mean, you talk about these great initiatives, do we need more money, more expertise, more tools? Where do we start?
Yeah, we need all of the above. We actually really need more workforce. I think one of the big part of it is the workforce development. I can tell you most doctors don't want to specialize in cancer in Africa right now because they say they only have to, you know, give a bad news to the patient. You know, they don't have the infrastructure to be able to treat. And so we really need to build a workforce in addition to developing facilities. You know, recently we've committed, you know, supporting the cancer center in Ghana. That's one initiative that I'm actually very proud of that we've been involved with. And that initiative, you know, with the Ashanti King and Dr. Beatrice Adai, who is leading that initiative, would really provide a comprehensive cancer center of excellence in West Africa so that you can marry that infrastructure along with workforce development. I think that those are the key things that need to happen.
That was Dr. Will Ngwa, director of the Global Health Catalyst with Johns Hopkins. We turn now to Ebola. Authorities in Sierra Leone have launched an Ebola vaccination campaign targeting at least 5,000 health workers. Many health workers caught the Ebola virus during the outbreak that hit West Africa a decade ago. Victoria Amunga reports from Kenema, Sierra Leone.
The name of dozens of healthcare workers who died in the 2014 Ebola outbreak. The names are displayed outside a hospital in Kenema, one of the worst hit cities during the two-year outbreak that killed nearly 4,000 people in Sierra Leone. Mohamed Feika, a healthcare worker here, recalls how many of his co-workers died after contracting Ebola while caring for patients.
That greatly affected me, looking at my social activity as well. You as well. I mean, let me just ignore myself. Let me look at other people.
Now there's an Ebola vaccination campaign to protect healthcare workers like Feika. The Gavi Vaccine Alliance in June launched a preventive Ebola vaccination program to help contain the disease and protect critical healthcare and frontline workers in high-risk countries like Sierra Leone.
There was that kind of fear among healthcare workers, even among the entire population. So upon taking the vaccine, I now have the confidence that maybe when there is an outbreak, I will not be infected.
The single-dose vaccine is being provided to healthcare workers in countries that have had Ebola cases and those that border countries that have experienced Ebola outbreaks. Oli Khan is Gavi's communication director.
It's going to be 20,000 vaccines to start with, and we feel this is sufficient to cover, you know, the frontline workers I've just mentioned and protect those that are most vulnerable. And then, of course, we will be replenishing the stockpile so that we still have that 500,000 and then moving to other countries that are at risk of high risk of Ebola outbreaks.
The Ebola virus is spread through contact with the bodily fluids of an infected person. The average fatality rate for Ebola is about 60%, according to Gavi. Since Sierra Leone is considered a high-risk area, the government has set up a public health agency to enhance detection of the disease and prevent further outbreaks. Dr. Mohamed Alex Vandi is with the National Public Agency in Sierra Leone.
We know we are in an endemic zone. We know it's only the matter of when and not if that will be an outbreak. Every week we have a suspected case that we have to respond to. So a dedicated agency has been created to just look at that, preparedness and response.
As part of the campaign, community and religious leaders are encouraging the public to accept the shots. The Reverend Usman Fona is one such leader.
We use the pulpit, the mosques use the minbar, the churches use the pulpit on Sundays and on Fridays, at weekday meetings. Also at naming ceremonies, when we go to name children, we let the congregation that are present to know the value of vaccination.
More than 11,000 people died during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa between 2014 and 2016, most of them in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. Authorities hope the Ebola vaccination campaign will help avert such a disaster in the future. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Kenema, Sierra Leone.
The West Africa Ebola outbreak of 2014 in Liberia claimed over 4,800 lives and exposed severe weaknesses in the country's healthcare system. Observers say the country was unprepared to face such public health crisis, especially after 14 years of civil war. I spoke with Dr. Maxo Luma, Executive Director of Partners in Health, PHI, Liberia, to discuss the lessons learned from Ebola and the ongoing efforts to strengthen public health infrastructure in the country.
When Ebola broke out in Liberia in 2014, Partners in Health was invited by the government of Liberia to join their response. And from 2014 all the way to 2015, there was a lot of focus around the response. But we as an organization, it was very obvious to us. As we got there, we realized that was a system, you know, hit by 14 years, you know, of civil war, where most of the healthcare workers who were working in this system either died or had to leave the country in order to survive.
Can you share some insights to the strategy that the organization adopted?
Everywhere we work around the world, in the 11 countries we work around the world, more than 95% of all our staff are always hired from the community. So when we say they from the community, they can be TB survivors, they can be Ebola survivors, they can be anything, because we live with the communities, we serve, we break bread with them, we stay with them. So it is a part of our DNA.
So how did the strategy evolve after Ebola?
After Ebola, and when Liberia declared, you know, Ebola free in 2016, all the focus was around health system strengthening. And Partners in Health made that call to stay, to work alongside the government of Liberia and the Ministry of Health, more specifically, to rebuild the system. And how did we do that? We know that you cannot strengthen any system without strengthening the people working in the system. And as part of our strategy, we've invested in what we call the five S's. The first S is staffing, in quality, in quantity, in order to provide safe and quality care for folks. The stuff can be all the equipment, all the diagnosis tool you need to work in the system, in the healthcare system. we invest in social support because we tend to work in, you know, the most impoverished communities where, for example, in Liberia, folks are living when they're less than $1 per day. You know, they're willing to accompany them and make sure they succeed for any, you know, thing, disease or thing they are dealing with. We want to make sure we address some of the social determinants of special diseases they are dealing with. We invest in dignified space to provide equality and respectful and, you know, dignified care to people. And we invest in system. And to build the capacity of the people living in the country, because we strongly believe investing in what we call the human local capital is the way to go. Because we strongly believe it is the responsibility of the locals and to work alongside the government to make sure basic primary health care, you know, are available for everyone. And therefore, we partner with academic institutions, including Harvard, you know, Brigham and Women's Hospital, the local universities, nursing school, midwifery school, to build the health workforce with local Liberians to ensure we have a system that is strong and stable enough and resilient enough and to respond to future public health events, because we don't know what the next public health event will be, but what we know for sure, we know how strong a healthcare system can be in order to, you know, minimize or decrease the magnitude of any future, you know, public health event. And that's the strategy we've been using. Now we are, you know, we just celebrated our 10-year anniversary since we've been in the country. There's a very meaningful transformation as a result of this strategy, building primary care to achieve universal health coverage.
That was Dr. Maxwell Luma, Executive Director of Partners in Health Liberia. Next, I spoke with Dr. Melindo Ndayizigiye, Executive Director of Partners in Health in Lesotho. We discussed the work of the organization on the ground, including the integration of mental health services and the use of technology.
Partners in Health work in Lesotho is providing comprehensive primary health care services in rural, hard-to-reach areas of Lesotho. We started the program in 2006 on the invitation of the Minister of Health to provide HIV treatment and care for the hard-to-reach communities which had no access to HIV services. Later, we realized that we cannot really improve health outcomes if we focus only on HIV. So Partners in Health has expanded its services to other, you know, primary health care services, including maternal child health, tuberculosis, non-communicable diseases, mental health, and later, in 2007, PIH realized that there was a need to support the government of Lesotho to develop or implement, treatment and care for multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. PIH was the first organization to support the government of Lesotho to establish a MDR-TB program. Since then, the program has been growing, and in 2014, we added another program on health system strengthening using the mode of care that we've been using in rural outreach areas with comprehensive primary health care, linking communities to primary health care facilities to the district hospitals. And we replicated the same model in four districts where we were focusing on three pillars of health system strengthening, including improving health service delivery, strengthening health system management, and professionalizing village health workers program.
So you went from a starting point with HIV/AIDS in 2006 to now, very comprehensive with various areas of focus. What would you say have been some of the most rewarding in terms of concrete results that you've seen on the ground?
We have seen significant impact in terms of improving access and the quality of health services. For example, we have seen an increase of 85% in terms of antenatal care services, and facility-based deliveries have increased 15 times compared to the baseline. And we have seen also an amazing treatment success rate in terms of MDR-TB treatment and care. Right now we are at 77% in terms of DRTB treatment success rate, while the global average is only 62%. And this is because of our approach and heavy investment in terms of five S's, qualified staff, good and dignified space, and having systems and supplies and social support for those, poor and underserved patients.
One of the things that you mentioned that has been added is mental health services. Mental health services are not readily available, especially when you go to remote areas, rural areas in some parts of Africa. Can you discuss any challenges faced in implementing these mental health programs and also early childhood interventions?
At PIH, we believe that both physical health and mental health are equally important. When we started to see problems of mental health, we just decided to see what can be done to really improve overall health outcomes and health well-being of the population. We started with integration of early childhood development interventions into primary health care because we know that when you have a good foundation, you have better outcome. And we know that when it comes to child care, the first 1,000 days are critically important to build the foundation of overall physical and well and mental health well-being of anybody. So we integrated early childhood intervention into postnatal care, where we were taking advantage of having mothers to when they come for postnatal care, and we train them on how to to build the foundation using an intervention called Save and Retain. And this has been also a good success for, to show what is possible to improve, the health outcomes of both mothers and babies. And one of the interventions that we had was to screen for postnatal care, depression. And we have realized that during the period of the intervention, 37% of mothers had, mild or moderate or severe form of mental health. And we then realized the need of expanding the integration of mental health into other programs like MDR-TB and overall primary health care services. And one of the challenges that we have faced was, when we screen, we need also to provide care. Yeah. And we have diagnosed, a lot of patients who needed care. And this has triggered us to, you know, to invest more in a well-trained mental health workforce in addition to the primary health care and MDRTB services.
How has technology been applied in your work? What role has it played as you have evolved in your mission on the ground?
So technology is very important. We know that to provide good quality care and also medicines evolves. So one of the technology that we have been using and brought to the primary health care level was use of artificial intelligence for screening of tuberculosis, and also using teleradiology for remote feedback from specialists. So this has been one of the great achievements in terms of improving diagnosis of tuberculosis, and also putting patients or initiating treatment on patients on early before TB gets too complicated. And right now, as I'm speaking, we are at 93% to the universal healthcare targets in our catchment area. And this is because of these innovative technologies and use of artificial intelligence and teleradiology that we brought to rural and hard-to-reach communities.
So is the technology, the AI, making diagnosis faster, treatment access quicker?
Use of AI and teleradiology is it makes diagnosis really fast. Before, when we were still using old technology, for example, when someone has or needs chest X-ray, we were using analog X-ray machines. These are like old technologies, and per day, for example, the maximum images that we were taking was around 10 in each facility. And this was because we have to develop films and make the images dry, and then have someone look at the film. But now, with the introduction of digital X-ray machines and the use of AI and teleradiology, the images are taken, and immediately, in less than 1 minute, you have first results read by the AI. And once the image is taken, is uploaded to a cloud database where our expert, our specialist, our radiologist is able to look at the images and give real-time feedback.
And that was Dr. Melino Ndayizigiye, Executive Director of Partners in Health in Lesotho. That is all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Khumudo, in Washington, with producer Mobilia Barrow and engineer Adrius Regis. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and